You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, How to Turn Your Independent Film into a Money-Making Business by Alex Ferrari. For a free copy of the audiobook, head over to www.filmbizbook.com.
The Director Series is made possible by the support of our subscribers on Special. Subscribe today at special.tv/The Director Series and gain access to exclusive full-length Director Series episodes and other bonus content, ad-free. Welcome to the Director Series podcast, a show dedicated to deconstructing the work of some of cinema's most celebrated and influential film directors. I'm your host, Cameron Bile.
What we do is we build a pipeline to Port Hueneme or Santa Paula. It's about 100 miles. And we do a deal with Union Oil. This is what we do. Then we don't need the railroads and their shipping costs anymore. You see?
Yeah.
You see that?
Yeah.
Then we're making money. We're making the real money that we should be making. We're not just throwing it away on shipping costs. Otherwise, it's just mud.
While on a trip to London, Anderson purchased a copy of Upton Sinclair's novel Oil, mainly because the cover image of California oil fields appealed to his homesickness. Transfixed by the novel's cinematic potential, he began pulling further inspiration from the biography of real-life California oil tycoon Edward Doheny, as well as John Huston's classic 1948 film, The Treasure of Sierra Madre, which he began watching on a nightly basis while he developed this new idea. Crowned with the lurid title There Will Be Blood, Anderson's story is set during the turn of the 20th century in a desert boomtown called Little Boston. Rather than a proper adaptation, Sinclair's novel instead serves simply as a starting point from which Anderson was able to branch out and accumulate a vast library of research material. With these resources at hand, he would ultimately construct his own version of the great American epic, a grand statement on capitalism, corruption, and the perversion of all-consuming ambition as part of our country's founding ideals, all embodied in one of the most original and compelling anti-heroes in cinematic history.
I have a competition in me. I want no one else to succeed. I see the worst in people, Henry. Having you here gives me a second breath. I can't keep doing this on my own. With these people.
Daniel Day-Lewis's career-defining, Oscar-winning portrayal of black-hearted oil tycoon Daniel Plainview possesses shades of Bill the Butcher from Martin Scorsese's Gangs of New York, only more intelligent and sophisticated in both temperament and taste.
That land has been had. Nothing you can do about it. It's gone. It's had.
If you would just take this lease, Daniel.
Train it, Eli, you boy.
He straight up devours every morsel of scenery in a role that was written expressly for him, looming larger than life while putting legendary screen villains like Bela Lugosi's Count Dracula or Anthony Hopkins' Hannibal Lecter on notice.
One night I'm going to come to you inside of your house, wherever you're sleeping, and I'm going to cut your throat.
What? What are you talking about? Have you gone crazy, Daniel? I heard what you said. What did you say?
Don't tell me about my son.
His horns are locked in mortal combat with Paul Dano's aspiring evangelical preacher, in a battle that pits capitalism against theocracy for the soul of Little Boston.
Get out of here. Don't you dare turn around and come back. For if you do, all the armies of my boot will kick you in the teeth. And you will be cast up and thrown in the dirt and thrust back to perdition. And as long I have teeth, I will bite you, and if I have no teeth, I will gum you. And as long as I have fish, I will bash you. Now get out of here,
As an ideological foil extorting Plainview into building a church for him and his flock, Dano's performance as Eli Sunday could have very easily been overshadowed by his co-star's scene-shredding gravitas. Fortunately, Dano more than holds his own as a vain, manipulative, so-called man of God, whose intentions are just as slimy as the devil he endeavors to destroy.
You are a stupid man, Abel. You've let someone come in here and walk all over us. You let him in and do his work here, and you are a stupid man for what we could have had.
There Will Be Blood focuses mainly on the duel between these two unconventional titans, thus eliminating the need for Anderson to recruit any of the members of his informal repertory. Working with a suite of fresh new faces, Anderson's focus is invigorated.
What are you looking so miserable about? There's a whole ocean of oil under our feet. No one can get at it except for me.
Despite the changing of the guard in front of the camera, Anderson still relies on most of his usual techno collaborators, producers Daniel Lupi and Joanne Seller, editor Dylan Tichenor, and cinematographer Robert Elswit, who won the second of the film's two Oscars for his stunning work here. Anderson's preferred anamorphic aspect ratio is perfectly suited to capture the dusty, earth-toned vistas and sweeping camera movements. While Anderson's visual language doesn't change physically, the dynamic of its intentions has. Elaborate camera moves project a grand scale that evokes the work of John Ford and John Huston, creating a distinct air of myth. The grandeur would almost be overwhelming, but Anderson's confidence and mastery of his craft assures a precisely calibrated balance of tone. Anderson scores a new collaborator and production designer Jack Fisk, who had already become a legend in his field for his work on Terrence Malick's films. With There Will Be Blood, Fisk does what he does best, bringing an authentic, lived-in period vibe designed to place us firmly in the time and place of the story. Fisk's attention to detail is truly incredible. Everything falls within Anderson and Elswit's established color palette, and nothing rings as false or out of place.
Days when I like to think of myself as an oil man. As an oil man, I hope that you'll forgive just good old-fashioned plain speaking. Now, this work that we do is very much a family enterprise. I work side by side with my wonderful son, H.W. I think one or two of you might have met him already.
Anderson's reinvention of his visual aesthetic extends to the music, where he finds creative refreshment in his collaboration with Radiohead guitarist Johnny Greenwood. The music in Anderson's films have always erred on the side of quirky, but in There Will Be Blood, the musical character mutates from John Bryan's curiously endearing compositions to something more classical and avant-garde. Greenwood uses harrowing, discordant strings to pervert the conventional orchestral sound into a droning, sonic reinforcement of the brutal images unfolding on screen. Anderson supplements Greenwood's compositions with classical source cues, like Arvo Pärt's Fratres Suite or Brahms' Violin Concerto in D major, tracks that create a distinctly Kubrickian vibe.
Al Rose has very generously provided some refreshment for this occasion out of his own pocket. Thank you. Don't you care to help yourselves? I'll be back in a minute.
Say it louder!
I've abandoned my child! I've abandoned my child! I've abandoned my boy!
At the center of the film is a tense dynamic between Plainview and his adopted son, H.W. A precocious and intelligent little boy whose increasing rebelliousness earns him a one-way ticket to an expensive boarding school in San Francisco. The elder Plainview is too consumed by his drilling operation to properly raise his son, and in the process inadvertently turns his little business partner into a competitor. Anderson's career-long exploration of family dynamics takes a left turn here in order to reflect Plainview's empty soul.
I'm a family man. I run a family business. This is my son and my partner, H.W. Plainview.
He uses H.W. to project the appearance of an affable family man, even as he takes over people's land and unashamedly robs them of the fortunes they never even knew they had.
I'm sorry, I don't know.
$6 an acre.
In the absence of a conventional plotline or story arc, the emotional climax of There Will Be Blood hinges on this tension between Plainview and H.W., which comes to a head when H.W. grows up and expresses a desire to start an oil company of his own down in Mexico with his wife.
For me to do my own drilling. And start my own company. This makes you my competitor.
Plainview sees this as an act of betrayal and rejects H.W. as his heir while revealing his true lineage.
You're not my son.
Please don't say that. I know you don't mean it.
Well, it's the truth. You're not my son. You never have been. You're an orphan. You ever hear that word? You're an orphan from a basket in the middle of the desert.
It's a pitiful power play that affords Plainview a fleeting, petty victory, but it's clear to us that he's damned himself to a short-lived future of loneliness and regret. In Anderson's eyes, tragedy befalls those who choose to permanently turn away from family. Plainview's ultimate tragedy is that for all the material wealth he could accumulate, he would always be emotionally and ideologically bankrupt.
You're a bastard from a basket!
Anderson's other thematic fascinations are present in There Will Be Blood, albeit in surprising ways. His stories and characters are inherently Californian in nature, meaning that they always reflect some aspect of the Golden State's rich cultural heritage. The oil boom that fueled the rise of cities like Bakersfield and Los Angeles is depicted here during its infancy. However, the film was shot far away from California, in Marfa, Texas. The endless sprawl of rocking oil derricks profoundly shaped California's geography and culture, and one need only to look at the expansive oil fields of LA's Baldwin Hills to see that black gold still continues to drive California's economy. There Will Be Blood's true brilliance lies in its understated relevancy to our modern age, and how we're still beholden to the Alcoma battles waged over a century ago. For all of our technological advances and progress as a society, we're still down there in the muck, blindly bludgeoning our way forward to prosperity. Anderson's filmography is greatly interested in sexuality, and There Will Be Blood is notable in this regard for its curious omission of all sexuality. Plainview is driven purely by greed, and hasn't the slightest care of what other people think of him, much less the opposite sex. Even the process of obtaining a son comes to him by way of something resembling more of a business transaction than the result of a sexual act. Further contrasted by H.W.'s taking of a wife towards the end of the film, the absence of Plainview's sexuality in itself is a profound comment on the intricate relationship between ambition and sexual longing, and how non-sexual pursuits like wealth and power can be obsessed over as a fetish in their own right. Anderson's classical, formalist style had been used to subversive effect in his previous work, but his full embrace of it in There Will Be Blood points to his maturation into a very different kind of filmmaker, one whose work is infused with an almost Orwellian sense of self-importance, oftentimes mistaken for pretension. The palpable influence of Robert Altman, Jonathan Demme, and Martin Scorsese in his previous films gives way to the canonized greats, John Huston, Stanley Kubrick, John Ford. As a whole, There Will Be Blood feels very Kubrickian.
I'm finished!
And a surefire nod to the Dawn of Man sequence in 2001 A Space Odyssey. The opening prologue runs for a full 20 minutes before the first line of dialogue is spoken. This choice doesn't come from a desire to deliberately emulate Kubrick, however. Instead, it comes from Anderson's supreme confidence in his skills as a visual storyteller, accumulated over the course of a decade as a professional director. In seeing Plainview doggedly persist against a series of debilitating mishaps to get his first oil well up and running, we learn far more about the ruthlessness and intelligence of the character than a line of dialogue could ever tell us. Of course, Anderson's knack for memorable and striking dialogue continues to be put to incredible use here.
From here to the coast, it's all Union oil.
What's this? Why don't I own this? Why don't I own this?
While there's less of it, Anderson manages to concoct some of the most quoted lines in recent film memory.
If you have a milkshake, and I have a milkshake, and I have a straw, there it is. That's a straw, you see. Watching. And my straw reaches across the room and starts to drink your milkshake. I drink your milkshake. I drink it up!
The film would have been iconic enough, even without the inclusion of Plainview's I Drink Your Milkshake monologue. But its presence and viral appeal elevates the film into the territory of unimpeachable greatness and cultural immortality. There'll Be Blood was hailed as a masterpiece when it was released, with critics praising it as an instant classic and a potent metaphor for our modern-day thirst for oil, a thirst that fueled the decade's most defining events. It is arguably Anderson's most successful film, with a wide swath of nominations at that year's Academy Awards, one of which being his own first nomination as a director. Anderson dedicated the film to the memory of his hero Robert Altman, and in doing so, he closed the book on the first part of his career, an era that Altman had directly influenced, and began an exciting new one, marked by laser-focused character studies and a sense of grandeur unmatched by any other filmmaker working today.
Thank you for listening to the Director Series. For a deeper dive into your favorite filmmakers, go to www.directorseries.net.
The Director Series is made possible in large part by our generous supporters on Patreon. Please visit us at patreon.com/directorseries to see how your contribution enables the continued production of video essays and text articles on your favorite contemporary and classic film directors. Thank you.